Thanks, Luis. All right, so it's really a pleasure for me to be here talking about modeling compact neutron star binary mergers. This is a very exciting field right now, and precisely because there's all of this progress going on right now in adding microphysics to our simulations. Okay, what's going on? All right. So, to help facilitate all these discussions we're going to be having this morning and this afternoon, I've decided to spend the next half hour talking about unsolved problems in modeling neutron star, and black hole neutron star binaries, which means I am going to be dropping in references as the talk goes on to my own recent work and that of other groups. But the focus is going to be on things that we haven't done rather than things that we have done. At least, you know, things that as far as I know we haven't done yet. Maybe I'll be surprised this afternoon. But these are the four problems that I'm going to be focusing on, and they're certainly not the only problems in modeling these types of mergers, but they're ones that interest me particularly and stuff that I'm working on to some extent. So let's remember what we want to get out of these simulations. So the first thing we want is gravitational waves, and we want to use the results of simulations by simulating a whole bunch of different binary cases and different characterizations of the equation of state to see how we can extract information about the binary and about the neutron star structure itself from the gravitational waves. And so if that's the business you're in, then the thing that you're most, the late-in spiral and early merger are very crucial to you and very crucial that you do it right. The piece of microphysics that you're most interested in this case, is the equation of state, the cold equation of state especially. We are also interested in doing these simulations because we want to test the viability of these events as sources of short-duration gamma ray bursts. And if that is the game that you're in, then the first thing that simulations do for you is they tell you if sort of what we think of as basic prerequisites for a functional gamma ray burst engine are satisfied. Namely, after the merger, do we end up with a substantial accretion disk around the post-merger black hole? Do we end up with a baryon clean region, say, on the poles? And so, you know, without these, it's thought that you're not going to be able to get a GRB, no matter what other microphysics you throw in. So once again, the equation of state is important for this. We want to do better with simulations. We also want to actually see, you know, the relativistic outflow being formed. And we should be able to do that, but only if we add in the microphysics that we believe is responsible for extracting energy from the disk or from the black hole spin, meaning, you know, magnetic fields and or neutrinos, we think. And finally, we're interested in ejecta, as material that is either flung out to infinity or at least becomes very loosely bound, so it's around the black hole for long times after merger. And so then you can be interested in our processes like Dr. Metzger was talking about yesterday. So simulations to date have clarified the pathways that neutron star, and black hole neutron star binaries follow when they get close enough to merge. So if one has a binary neutron star, when the two neutron stars merge, then you are left immediately after the merger with a very massive, very rapidly and differentially rotating and very hot remnant of nuclear matter. If this remnant has a mass greater than the so-called supermassive limit, that is the maximum mass above which a neutron star cannot be stable if it's only uniformly rotating, then the remnant is not going to be stable in the long run. And eventually, sooner or later, differential rotation is going to be removed, and then the object is going to collapse to a black hole plus disk system. And the only question is how long is this going to take. For very massive systems, it seems that the remnant collapses very promptly on a dynamical time scale, for lower mass systems, but still hypermassive, that is, you know, above the supramassive limit, then the remnant will survive for a tenth of a second or so until either gravitational waves or magnetic processes remove centrifugal support from the center so that you collapse to the black hole plus disk system. If you have a black hole and a neutron star in a binary, then the in-spiral can end in one of two ways. Either the neutron star can reach the its ISCO of the orbit and can plunge directly into the black hole, or the neutron star can be tidally disrupted by the black hole's gravity first. And only in the latter case does it seem possible to get a significant accretion disk. So most of the numerical work has gone into studying that case. As you know, the plunge case seems to be, at least in terms of gravitational waves, very similar to a binary black hole. So a somewhat disappointing finding from the first years of GR simulations is that some of the neat things that we've been seeing in Newtonian simulations, such as those of Janka and Rosswag, didn't seem to carry over to general relativity simulations, at least for field binaries. So, for example, the Newtonian simulations would often find a whole lot of unbounded ejecta, which would have been, you know, very interesting, but that seems to be much harder to get in GR. Also, for the black hole neutron star case, if you had stiff equations of state in Newtonian physics, it seemed easy to get neat cases where accretion of the, where tidal disruption of the neutron star would turn on and off. And that all seems to go away when you add relativity. So going on to how we do these simulations. So if you want to evolve the nuclear matter, then you have to evolve the hydrodynamics and, you know, ideally the radiation magnetohydrodynamics equations. And right now, pretty much everyone in the field is using finite difference, finite volume, high resolution shock capturing methods where we write the equations in conservative form so that the change, the rate of change of mass, energy, and momentum inside a grid cell is just given by the flux going through that cell, plus some kind of gravity source term. And the thing that really sets apart one hydro method from another, it all comes down to how you compute these fluxes on cell faces. So there is a process whereby one interpolates from the center of the cell to the edge. This is called reconstruction. And then after you have a flux on either side of the face, then you have essentially a Riemann problem that you solve to, so therefore there's a Riemann solver. And this effectively combines the two interpolants and gives you the total flux on each side. So although this is what we're all sort of doing right now, and, you know, our only differences are what reconstructor do we use, what Riemann solver do we use, there are alternatives out there, like particle methods and finite element type methods, spectral type methods, that may be promising. The code that I in particular use is my collaborators use is the spec code, which does hydro basically the way everyone else does. But it evolves the metric using pseudospectral methods, which seems to work very, you know, great for binary black hole systems, and it works decently well for black hole neutron star systems. And so one of the you can't see that at all, can you? That's just as well. The errors get kind of bad towards the end. One of the newest things that we're doing is a graduate student at Caltech, Jeff Kaplan, is applying SPEC to do binary neutron stars. This is still work in progress, but there don't seem to be any insurmountable problems. All right, so 9 minutes in, we get to our first problem, and that is doing accurate in spirals. So it's still a live question exactly how much information LIGO is going to be able, you know, advanced LIGO, given its noise and given how far away binaries are expected to be. How much information it's going to be able to extract about, say, the equation of state, whether it's going to be able to constrain it at all. But regardless, you know, if there's any chance, we certainly want to have very accurate waveforms. And in the late in spiral, that means we have to do it numerically, and we have to do it numerically very accurately. Right now, the record, as far as I know, for binary neutron stars, by Adi et al., has recently done a 10-orbit in spiral for an equal mass system with sufficient accuracy that they were able to use their waveforms to calibrate the tidal corrections to an EOB formulation, which shows the sort of thing that you can potentially do with these sorts of accurate in spirals. As far as I know, the longest black hole neutron star simulation is our work, which is unpublished, but a Cornell graduate student, Curran Mulberger, who's also adding MHD to our code, has done a 9-orbit in spiral with we believe, sort of comparable phase errors, maybe a bit worse. And so doing accurate in spirals or systems for compact binaries with neutron stars has all the same problems as binary black holes, except then there's also this problem of the neutron star surface, which really hurts our accuracy. And in fact is, I believe, the main source of error in a lot of our in-spirals now. So because there's a discontinuity, it's at least at some derivative, then we're always going to see conventional hydro methods drop to first order there. Also, since density is going to zero, you are getting, the sound speed is going to zero, and it's easy to get for errors to build up into shocks in this region and cause anomalous heating coming from the surface. And as a matter of fact, the problem is worse than we had thought when we had been spending all our time with gamma equals 2 polytropes, because those were a particularly nice system to do surface-wise. As you can see in this TOV profile that I've plotted, the black line is a gamma equals 2 polytrope that you see goes sort of nicely, linearly to zero when you enter the surface. And the blue line is for a Latimer-Swesty 220 equation of state, but it could be any realistic equation of state, really. And you see that the profile is a lot nastier when you get towards the surface. It sort of takes a dive. And another issue is that these errors are sort of more unforgiving if you're wanting to look at the neutrino radiation, because it depends on high powers of temperature. So this heating matters a lot. So for this case where I have 80 points across the star, which is not unreasonable, you can see that we're clearly fairly under-resolved towards the surface. So another issue that it might be good to bring up while the nuclear physics people are here is that we, at least two groups, are having trouble making conversion initial data for our binary simulations, and that's because of non-smoothness in the equation of state tables. So if you take numerical derivatives and things like this, it looks bad. And so either we or they have to work on, a good way of smoothing the tables. So how can you solve these problems? There's two problems. First, there's the steepness issue, and then there's the actual discontinuity issue. The steepness issue, the solution seems to be that you need to just put more grid near the surface. And so one can do that, say, with a coordinate transformation. We made up a simple arctangent map, and that seems to fix the problem significantly. If you look at this first plot, this is where we have the same amount of grid, but we moved it from the center from uniform to concentrated near the surface, and you get factors of 3 or 6 improvement depending on what you're doing with essentially no loss in time step, because we're accuracy rather than Courant limited. So one can also try playing with the scheme. With the hydro scheme, changing reconstructors and changing Riemann solvers. And in the bottom plot I've showed, you can get some improvements there. At least you want to make sure you're not making a really bad choice, but you won't completely solve these sorts of problems. As for the actual discontinuity, maybe we can live with it, but it's also worth considering, sort of special numerical techniques that can handle these sorts of things. So one can try, for example, Hartan subcell modeling, anti-diffusive fluxes, ghost fluids, that sort of thing. And finally, I'll say that it's possible that the completely other numerical techniques, particularly those that give you more flexibility in gridding, like multi-patch finite volume methods or discontinuous Galerkin methods that we're going to be hearing about later today, might do better or might have completely different problems. Yes. So we have what density ranges? I sort of mean, so you know, I mean the density goes exactly to zero at the surface, right? Although in our atmosphere code, we sort of, we impose in our numerical codes, we impose atmospheres that are many orders of magnitude below the maximum density. Yes. Well, and you can, yeah. Yes, that's what I was saying. There's two problems. There's the actual discontinuity and there's the sharpness problem. And so one of them is sort of a gritty, I think of more of as a gritting problem, and one of them I think of as a numerical methods problem, you know. Okay, well, let's take a look here. I mean, so, you know, you can sort of see it's in, you know, roughly one-tenth of the maximum density is where this dive is happening. So that's, you know, what, you know, 10 to the minus 13, 10 to the minus 12 range or so, grams per cubic centimeter. I'm sorry, I didn't hear that last comment. Yeah. So actually, if you go down to, you know, down to another order of magnitude or so below, you'll actually see that you can't really see it here, but the density then becomes a sort of tail type thing, and so it behaves differently again. But I'm thinking that low density region is probably not important, given that you're sort of more interested in the bulk for these sorts of calculations. Yeah, I mean, it's probably a couple orders of magnitude. Can I zoom in on the... If I look on at what? Okay, let's see. All right, so we're zooming in on the surface, huh? Okay, so we see that we are having a nice fall off, then we get down to this, you know, one-tenth level, and then it steepens, and then when we go to very low density, then we see that it sort of turns over again like this. And so the issue that I've been concentrating on is sort of this region, I think, is the main problem. Maybe I didn't hear you right. Okay. Uh-oh. I'm really falling behind. Okay, let's see. What can I skip? Okay, problem two. This isn't really microphysics, but it's so interesting that I want to bring it up briefly anyway. And that's the black hole neutron star parameter space. So because there's a whole bunch of variety in the black hole mass and spin, you can get very different regimes. So this is a very busy plot, but let me just spend a minute on it. So you can see here I've plotted, this is sort of the parameter space in black hole spin magnitude, assuming that the black hole spin is aligned with the orbit, so A over M from 0 to 1. And on the vertical axis, I have the mass ratio. Actually, I've plotted black hole mass divided by the total mass. So when you get up to one, that means that the black hole, you know, is infinitely massive, you know, or supermassive. And so this blue line I've drawn is the point at which the neutron star disrupts right at the ISCO. And as you can see, it depends on both of these parameters. For very massive black holes, that makes the tidal forces weaker, and so you're more likely to have the neutron star not disrupt until after you're past the ISCO and thus get more disk. And on the other hand, the black hole spin makes a disruption more likely for two reasons. First, it moves the ISCO in, and second, it increases tidal forces at the ISCO region, since, the ring singularity is moving out. And so the sort of lower right region is the region that we're most interested in. And basically, all four corners of this plot are interesting, except maybe the upper left, where the neutron star is basically a point particle. That's interesting, but not to us hydro people. And so these dots that I've drawn are the cases that we or other people have done or are doing. And as you can see, we're only sort of now getting up to what is we expect to be the most astrophysically likely case, which I've shown with this dotted red line. Which is the about 7-to-1 mass ratio. And then, there are still rather unexplored limits. So first thing one can, let's first take a look at the lower right-hand side of this plot, where we have the low mass ratio, the low black hole mass, high black hole spin region. This is very interesting because you can get very massive disks. So this plot is disk mass divided by black hole mass as a function of spin, combining our results and those of the University of Illinois, and you can get up to something like 10% of the mass can be in the disk, in which case the disk self-gravity might be especially important, and there's all sorts of instabilities that might come into play. So some of the things you might think of are not seen, although we, of course, look for them. A couple of very interesting recent papers have found, by Korobkin et al. And Kiyuchi et al., have found that these disks disks like this can be unstable to the Papaloisiu-Pringle instability. You get this unstable M equals 1 mode, so the disk leans to one side, and so by conservation of momentums, the black hole has to lean to the other side, and they both wobble together. And since there's a lot of mass involved, that means you can get a significant gravitational wave signal. So that's really neat things that can happen in this regime. Now let's move up to right in the middle of my phase space plot, the realistic Q high spin region. So this is something that that Francois Foucart in our group is working on. And for more information about that, talk to him or look at his poster. But so we're looking at 5-to-1 and 7-to-1 mass ratios and several different compactions for the neutron star. And it does seem like, if you crank up the spin high enough, and especially if you have a fat neutron star, then you can get significant disks, and they're very largely extended, as you can see in this plot. So now adding a third dimension, there is the black hole spin misalignment, and we have done a paper where we've studied this, and it can affect the disk mass. It basically, depending on what the misalignment is, you lose the advantages of that the black hole spin had given you, and you get a tilted disk which precesses, although on a very long time scale. Something really exciting that's happened in the last, month or so, is we've seen the first papers that have looked at eccentric black hole neutron star binaries. So the idea, the situation here is that you have a compact binary that's, you're in a globular cluster, and these two compact objects are thrown into, very close to each other, and they merge in a very eccentric way. So the first simulations of this were done by Lee et al. In Newtonian physics, and then just recently Branson Stevens et al. Of the Princeton group did a GR simulation of this. And so the interesting things that you find is, first of all, you can get large disks even with no black hole spin, and you can get all that stuff that we had thought that we can't see in GR anymore that the Newtonian simulations found. They give the first GR simulations to give you a significant amount of unbounded ejecta. There are cases where the core survives for multiple accretion events, and you even get the so-called zoom whirl type behavior that is sometimes seen in binary black holes. Okay. Moving on to a third problem. I'm sorry if I'm talking fast, but I'm trying to make up for lost time. Don't want to take away from Dave's time, or more importantly, our coffee break. is, so jumping directly into microphysics, there's the neutrino transport. Neutrinos are very important in our cases, first because they, of their effect on the thermal properties of the disk. They cool the disk, you know, by, you know, taking away thermal energy. And then the neutrinos, you know, carry this energy out, and it's possible in regions where the optical depth is around one that they'll be absorbed and they will heat the disk and potentially produce a thermal wind, which is good for outflows, although potentially bad for GRBs. They create radiation pressure. They change the YE, the composition of the fluid, which we of course want to know, you know, for various reasons, you know, especially with the outflow, we want to know that. But we even want to know it for dynamical reasons, because, so for example, in Lee et al., one of their papers, they were simulating post-merger disks, and they found that, you know, the evolution of YE ended up giving them an inverted lepton gradient and actually drove convection that wouldn't have been there otherwise. And then finally, there's the neutrino antineutrino annihilation that could be a major source of energy for GRBs. So last year at MICRA 2010, I had shown you how. Is that so? 2009. Oh, I better fix this before I email you these slides. At the last MICRA conference, I was there, and I presented my first black hole neutron star binaries using the Shen equation of state. Up until now, we hadn't used hot nuclear equations of state. And that was great. So just changing the equation of state was easy, but I didn't know what to do with the composition. So I just did two sort of hacky things. I tried just advecting it, so it's sort of, you know, weak time scales go to infinity. Or the other thing I tried doing was imposing instantaneous beta equilibrium while also saying that neutrinos instantly escape, so their chemical potential is zero. And so here are the two things give. They sort of give similar temperature evolution, you know, creeping up, you know, past 2 MeV for the average temperature. They give very different compositions. And so at this year's MICRA conference, we've added YE evolution through a neutrino leakage scheme, so we can actually see which of these, you know, is more accurate. And so we see that, you know, as expected for early times, you start out with the composition being similar to the advected case, and then over a sort of, you know, 30 millisecond or so time scale, that it's going to creep up towards the beta equilibrium case as the disk re-leptonizes. And you can get a neutrino luminosity signal, and we see that we are anti-neutrino dominated, as expected, since you have a very de-leptonized disk, you know, radiating. So this is the first thing that people have tried doing, a couple groups at least, is doing neutrino leakage. And so this is mostly just to get our feet wet. So in this case, you don't do transport. You just know that energy is being and lepton number are being removed at approximately some rate. And so you just make those disappear at each grid point in your code. And so at the last MICRA meeting, the first two leakage codes to go into general relativistic simulations were presented, and they were both published in the proceedings. So one of them was the GR1D code by O'Connor and Ott, and that's basically what the one in the leakage code in SPEC is based on. And then there was the other by Sekiguchi. And Sekiguchi's leakage code has most recently been used for this very exciting simulation work that he and Shibata and others did, where they did binary neutron star simulations with neutrino radiation on. And so like our black hole neutron star simulations, they found it to be the radiation is anti-neutrino dominated. You can detect the neutrinos out to 10 megaparsecs, so we'd have to be very lucky. And they raised the intriguing possibility that there may be some hypermassive stars will actually collapse, not because of angular momentum transport, but because of radiation taking away thermal support. So the next step is we all want to do real transport, and so there have been some first tentative steps in this direction. So the first thing that was done back in 2008, Stu Shapiro's group put out a gray diffusion code, and so they had, so there was no frequency dependence, and they had imposed essentially optically thick Eddington factor equals 1/3 everywhere, which may be quite crazy in the outer regions, but you know, maybe they could do some interesting physics on the in interiors of their disks, but they haven't really used this for much yet. So just this year, Shibata has proposed a truncated moment formulation, which could be very good, although as far as I know, people haven't coded it yet. And yesterday we heard Abdi Kamalov talking, who is working with a bunch of people to develop and solve the full 60 Boltzmann problem using Monte Carlo methods. And so for those of us who are thinking about what to do, questions I'd like to talk about is, you know, first of all, what's the minimum we need to do to avoid missing any qualitative effects? And so the thing I hate about leakage is not so much that, you know, things are off by 30-50%, but the fact that you have entire effects, physical effects, that are just not there at all, right? And there's no heating, no transport, and so forth. And you know, so what do we need to? What are the physical effects we expect? And you know, and how can we be sure that we catch them to some extent? And also, what can we afford with our current numerical resources? You know, what do we have to settle for? So now, finally, I'd like to move to MHD and instability issues. And I'm over. So can I spend like 5 minutes on this, maybe? Okay. Thanks. Okay, I'm going to talk about your work, Luis, so it's in your interest. Okay, so there's been some great progress this year. So there have been the first magnetized black hole neutron star simulations. There has been, Shibata has done simulations of how magnetic winding can create EM signals in the hypermassive star. Perhaps most impressively, Rizzola et al. Have done some binary neutron star simulations with magnetic fields on. And you know, following this out all the way through the remnant collapse and disk formation, and then seeing the magnetic field amplified to 10 to the 15 Gauss levels inside an axial jet, and creating an unbounded outflow. So they're advertising this as here's the missing link. You know, the energy extraction mechanism we've been wanting to see that takes us from smashing stars together to actually seeing how the GRB is generated. So that's really great. So MHD does raise some issues that are either unsolved or are just getting solved. One of them is there's the magnetosphere region, where T mu nu for the magnetic field dominates over T mu nu for the gas. That is the force-free limit. This region, even though the actual it's not affecting the gravity. But it's very important for electromagnetic type things. For example, it's what the region where the Blandford-Zaniac effect happens and energy is extracted from the black hole spin. There's also this intriguing suggestion that before binary neutron star mergers, the magnetospheres may interact in interesting ways. Maybe you could get some kind of signal out before the actual GRB happens. So you really want to study this regime. Unfortunately, standard MHD codes have trouble there. And so the solution, there's sort of two solutions, right? I mean, you know, we want to evolve the force-free region. So either you want to have an MHD code that doesn't go bad in this region, formulated somehow so that doesn't happen, or you want to just switch to solving the force-free equations there. And so this problem has been essentially solved in the latter way. By Palenzuela et al. And so they've developed a force-free code for GR, and they've been using it to study the Blandford-Zaniac effect now in binary black holes. And they've just recently announced that they've coupled this to their MHD code, so now they can start looking at binary magnetospheres and neat things like that. So I'm expecting there's some really exciting things that are going to come out of this work. So some trouble I see coming ahead is from the magnetorotational instability that drives the accretion. So the MRI is interesting in that there's sort of a narrow range of wavelengths wherein it grows. So in particular, if you look at the fastest growing modes wavelength, for typical values of the accretion disk, you get something like 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 centimeters. And so that's big enough that we're able to capture it, which is why Biotti et al. Were able to see the MRI in their simulations, their missing link simulations. On the other hand, if you're doing hypermassive simulations, the density is much higher. The Alphane speed is characteristically lower, and lambda MRI is much lower, you know, down to like 10 to the minus 4 times the radius. So this is very difficult. I don't see how AMR is going to help us here because the MRI is everywhere. there are only two solutions I know of. One is the old one from Dewey et al. And so forth, is just crank up B to unrealistic levels. Dewey himself is unsatisfied with this. The only other thing I know of, though, is you have to basically couple your large-scale MHD simulation to some sort of MRI subgrid model, and we've presumably calibrated to shearing box simulations. So there are some subgrid models out there. There's still a live question that's being studied of how well, you know, even shearing disk models, you know, much less what things that are based on them, capture the MRI effects. And in particular, there's a paper that came out on AstroPH yesterday by Sarathia et al. Looking at this, and I haven't even had time to read it yet. But they're saying it seemed that it got the stress pretty much right. And so then there's, you know, other fluid instabilities, Kelvin-Helmholtz. There's still, I think, and then there's turbulence. How do we, you know, that we sort of hand-wavily say that we're getting turbulence in some cases, but how do we really identify it? How do we know that we're evolving it correctly? What is the effect of radiation going to be on the disk turbulence, on our inflow, disk inflow, and so forth? So to conclude, I would have liked to have spent a lot more time on that previous slide, but I better not. We can talk about any of those things. So there have been a lot of papers, and especially impressively, a lot of letters this past year on this subject, so it's a very hot topic. But there are a lot of challenges we're facing now, and some of them that, you know, the hard part is even maybe still ahead. So thank you.
Hello. So thanks, Matt. That was very good. I like how you explain everything in a very positive way. The Obama administration should hire you as a press secretary. And any questions?
What to you would be the ideal realistic equation of state table?
So the first thing that I think would be ideal about it is that it would be more than one table. I would like to have something where, you know, there's, say, a half dozen of them, or at least three of them, where I can dial the stiffness to some extent, or whatever you decide is the most relevant, you know, single parameter. I think we can only deal with probably one parameter here, because, you know, the number of simulations becomes prohibitive if you have too many. But, you know, we sort of want to have, you know, several options, none of which are completely excluded, you know, by observation states. That's one thing. The other thing is we would like the table to be smooth enough so that there's no discontinuous features in there. So certainly no unphysical ones, but it might even be necessary to smooth out slightly, you know, physical discontinuities. So one thing is, you know, I guess, you know, we just, you know, so we certainly don't want discontinuities because of, you know, low resolution in the table. Although, you know, I guess, you know, well, no, I guess we can, just having sufficiently smooth interpolation will fix that, but yeah. So glitchiness is a thing to worry about, and probably the way to know about this is just, you know, just to have a friend who does numerical simulations, and they'll tell you if they have problems, and, you know, and that's probably the way to proceed, you know, rather than just trying to figure out for yourself, you know, looking at this curve, does this look good, and should they be having trouble? So.
When you say smooth, you mean the adiabatic index as a function of density?
So I guess I mean, so say taking the first couple of derivatives of the energy. So, you know, we use the energy, we use the pressure, and we use the sound speed. And so those all have to be sort of well-behaved in some sense.
You had mentioned that the disk predicts cooled by emitting neutrinos and then the luminosities of antineutrinos is much larger. Has anybody estimated how much mass can be ejected by this neutrino wind?
By the neutrino wind. There's only this one simulation that I know of that actually got the that actually had the wind because it had neutrino heating, and that's that the Desart et al. Paper from 2008 or so. And I think they were claiming that they could get something like 10 to the minus 4 solar masses. And Christian, you were an author on that paper. What was it? Yeah, that was a hypermassive neutron star blowing wind. And so for the wind that's going to come off of the disk, we don't know. At least, you know, simulations haven't done it yet. Yeah, thanks. I should have pointed that out to him first thing.
I was going to say there's some analytic stuff you can do. There's in the same motivation as like Chin and Woosley's work in terms of spherical neutrino-driven outflows. There's some work in 2008 looking at outflows from the disk, and it's a very similar scaling in terms of how the mass loss depends on neutrino luminosity and energy. So if you know how long the disk lasts and what the luminosity is in principle, you could estimate how much mass is being driven using Chin and Woosley's formulas. So I think 10 to the minus 4 solar masses, or maybe 10 to the minus 3 is probably realistic.
Okay, so maybe what Dave sets up, would you want to say a few more words about the discrepancy between the SPH and the whiskey results? Because that probably will be part of the discussion that we have in the afternoon.
Yeah, so, okay. I asked, maybe somebody has figured this out now, and I just didn't hear about it. But so last time when I was at the APS meeting, at least a year ago, I think I asked Bruno Giacomazzo about this, and he didn't have a really good explanation for it yet. And he's a very honest guy, so he would say so. So Price and Roswag did their binary neutron star simulations, and they got these, you know, Kelvin-Helmholtz vortices, and they found the magnetic field basically being amplified up to equipartition, as far as they can tell. And so, on the other hand, the simulations with Whiskey are seeing that it basically only goes up by an order of magnitude. And I haven't seen a good explanation for why, what the discrepancy is, why, it, and which one is correct.
Related to that, there was earlier this year a paper by the Garkin group where it just took a shear box and essentially just set up this Kelvin-Helmholtz to see how far would the electromagnetic field get to, and they agreed with Stefan Roswell, Price and Roswell. So it would suggest that maybe it's a resolution, lack of resolution.
They both have resolution issues. They have very different resolution issues.
Right, but not the shear box. So the shear box study is very highly resolved.
Yeah.
Yeah. So your impression then is that the SPH results are the ones to be trusted. Okay, so meaning that we have some, you know, very strong magnetic field in small regions. Yeah, so that would be interesting. Depending on how much that can spread out, that could, you know, alleviate our MRI problem. On the other hand, you know, it's only in these little vortices. So
if the field gets too strong, you can actually suppress the MRI. So maybe you don't have to worry about it after all. If the field gets too strong, you can actually suppress the MRI.
That's
so you don't maybe have to worry about it after all.
Okay, so let us thank Matt again.